Immigration is in the news. I like to get the facts from Professor Cindy Bies, professor of law at Southern Illinois University. Professor, as always, thanks for taking the call. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me today.
And we're just about 16 days away from the inauguration of President-elect Trump. Obviously, immigration has been a big issue in both of his, well, all three of his campaigns. And now we are entering a conversation about birthright, citizenship, deportation, some other things. And so I'd like to just kind of get your unbiased, nonpartisan take on a few of these things, okay?
Sure.
Can you explain what birthright citizenship is here in the U.S.? How do we get to have this thing?
Sure. Under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, anyone who is born in the United States, meaning on U.S. soil, is entitled to citizenship. So you can also get citizenship through your parents. So if you're born abroad, perhaps to a military member or someone who's working abroad, but your parents have U.S. citizenship, you can also claim it through ancestry through your parents.
And this clause, the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment, which obviously comes after the Civil War, was maybe in direct response, I believe, to one of the famous cases that people now accept as getting it completely wrong, the Dred Scott case. Do I have that kind of jurisprudence history correct?
Yes, that's right. In Dred Scott, you know, of course, they found that the former slave there could be returned to his owner and did not have rights of a citizen. And so, of course, we had the Civil War ending slavery and the passage of the Reconstruction Amendments, meaning the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment is the one that includes the birthright citizenship clause.
Is the language pretty clear? Because I'm surprised that this is even a debate whether we could get rid of birthright citizenship through judicial means. It seems to me that you would need to, I don't know, have a constitutional amendment to change this. Or do some people see that there's some nebulousness in the language? Do you see what I'm asking here?
Yeah, I do. And I think overwhelmingly scholars agree that it would require a constitutional amendment. The Supreme Court interpreted the 14th Amendment birthright citizenship clause way back in the 1890s in a case called Wong Kim Ark, where a Chinese American was born to Chinese immigrant parents in the San Francisco area. And the government at one point tried to deny that the child who was born in the United States was entitled to citizenship. And it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said no, that in fact the birthright citizenship clause does confer citizenship on someone who is born in the United States, even if the parents are not U.S. citizens. So that's been the law for 150 years or so. I think the one area where I've seen some folks try to argue that maybe there's some wiggle room is that the statute says that someone who is born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof is entitled to the citizenship. And so some folks have argued that that subject to the jurisdiction thereof gives some wiggle room for interpretation. But again, the Supreme Court has said pretty clearly that anyone born in the United States to non-U.S. parents are still U.S. citizens.
Meaning, I guess I'm trying to find the wiggle room myself because I just want to understand both sides of the argument. I think I hear from the other, from some folks on the side that saying that we should get rid of birthright citizenship, that little subject to the jurisdiction thereof would mean maybe, let's just put a finer point on it, immigrants who have been crossing the U.S. border illegally into the United States, citizens of other countries, if someone was then born, maybe that their parents that had crossed the border illegally were not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. It says they weren't citizens. Is that the wiggle room that they're kind of trying to find there? Am I interpreting that correct?
I think some people have tried to make that argument. But if you make that argument that they're not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States while in the United States without permission, you're also saying they're not subject to our criminal laws.
Right.
Or, you know, we couldn't prosecute them, which doesn't really make any sense. And of course, the child who is born here is subject to our laws, right? They're born here. And so regardless of the status of the parent, that interpretation doesn't really make a lot of sense. And so we can have a policy debate about whether birthright citizenship should be continued, and you could have a constitutional process where that could be debated and voted on, whether we should amend the Constitution. But doing it short of a constitutional amendment, I think, is a far-fetched argument.
Right, because what's the mechanism, right? If the Trump administration said we are ending birthright citizenship, there'd be implications with issuing Social Security cards. There'd be some, I imagine, immediate challenges to that ruling.
Oh, absolutely. There would be lawsuits. You know, there are millions of people in the United States. And, you know, many of them were born to parents who are here lawfully, who are lawful permanent residents, but who had not yet become U.S. citizens, but had children, you know, while they were in a lawful status. And so it's not just about folks who don't have lawful status. There are many, many people with lawful status who've been here a long time, who have children while they're here. And so, you know, presumably all of those folks would be challenging any attempt to take away the children's citizenship.
For folks that have been naturalized maybe in the last year or two, and maybe people coming into power in the next few weeks would say we didn't like the process in which that happened, either through naturalization or granted temporary protected status, can those things be reverse engineered? Maybe it's a different answer for which status we're talking about there, but can an administration come in and say, hey, anyone under the Biden administration that became a naturalized citizen or was granted temporary protected status, we're reversing that? I've heard some people fearing that.
So with temporary protected status, that is a limited time program. And when that expires, the Trump administration does have the ability to not renew it. So that's one category. With respect to those who have been naturalized, though, it's very, very hard to undo someone's naturalized citizenship once it is given. There are a couple of ways that that could happen, that you can lose your citizenship. You may know the old famous cases from World War II where people lied. They were part of the Hitler Nazi regime. Maybe they were, you know, prison guards at concentration camps. They lied when they came to the United States and said, you know, they had some other role. And then later their lies were uncovered and the government brought proceedings to denaturalize them because they had lied and their naturalization was based on those lies. So that is one way that you can lose your citizenship. A second way you can do it is if you take up arms against the United States. So there, you know, have been some cases where people have fought for terrorist organizations or, you know, on behalf of foreign governments and renounced their U.S. citizenship or had it taken away from them because they actively fought against the United States. But for the most part, the courts have approached denaturalization as sort of an extreme remedy that they are reluctant to grant. And so the proof has to be pretty strong before someone is denaturalized.
708 wants to know, and I appreciate all these questions, right, because we're on a fact-finding mission here today. 708 says, if one is in the United States illegally, why should that person have the same rights as a U.S. citizen? Just asking. I think that we need to clarify that just because you're in the United States illegally doesn't mean you have the same rights. If your child was then born in the United States, they would have those rights, but not you in the United States having the same rights as a citizen, correct?
That is correct. And so the person who is here illegally would not share all of the same rights. They have some rights. They would have a right, for example, to be free of cruel and unusual punishment or to be tortured or something like that. But they wouldn't have all of the same rights of a U.S. citizen. But you're right. The child who is born here, we kind of consider them an innocent, right? They didn't choose their status. And under our Constitution, the child is entitled to the status of a U.S. citizen. Now, that doesn't mean, however, that if the parents get deported, the child always stays. The parent would have to make a choice that either they take the child with them when they leave the country, or if, you know, the U.S. citizen child could stay, but they would have to make arrangements with family members or guardians to take care of the child, you know, if the parents were deported.
Right. So let's say the kid is 6 months old or a year old. Obviously, they can't make that decision themselves. They are afforded the right to stay if there's a safe situation for them to do so. But many parents probably feel like their child would be best with them even as they're being deported.
Yeah, I mean, those are obviously very tough decisions. You know, presumably the parents are here because they think they have a better life here. And they want that child to have access to that life, whether that's, you know, education or just safety. But, you know, many parents don't want to be separated from their children. That would be a heart-wrenching decision to have to make.
Okay. I've got a couple other questions on the text line, and then I want to talk a little bit more about that second part of the equation, deportation, with Professor Cindy Byes from Southern Illinois University, walking through immigration law here in the U.S. She's our go-to for that. And a lot of great text questions coming in, Cindy. Someone was just making sure they understood that even if you knew the intent of the parents was to just be here for the birth of a child to grant them citizenship, there's no way to revoke that. The intent of the parent crossing the border illegally simply for that motivation, there's not a mechanism to undo it that way as of right now.
Not really. In fact, there were some places in California some years back, I don't know if this is still going on, where they were particularly known at one point for being organized by a group of folks from China. And there were homes for, like, maternity homes for moms where they would come over, have their child here, and then oftentimes they would take the child back to China for several years, but they wanted the child to have U.S. citizenship to later be able to come back to school in the United States if they had wanted to do that. And so this was certainly more, you know, wealthy and educated folks who knew about the scheme and could afford to do something like that. But that was something that was happening for a while. So no. Now, when you come to the United States, you have to apply for a visa, either a temporary or a permanent visa. And if you're coming on a temporary visa, you have to have what's called non-immigrant intent, meaning that you're only coming for a short time and you don't plan to stay. And so, you know, when the consular officers from the United States are interviewing people and granting the visas, it's their job to sort of figure out what the parent's intent is. And, you know, they could deny a visa because they believe the parents are coming with an improper intent, you know, not for the visa that they are applying for. So that's one way to stop it. But, of course, you know, it's difficult to read people's minds. People lie. You know, there are reasons why some people would come with the wrong intent for the kind of visa that they've requested.
Yeah, and I can understand why some people don't love the idea, especially that situation where you describe where it's literally set up to, you use the word scheme, and I think most people would agree, someone's coming here to have the baby, they then immediately go back home only to years later have a fast track to get that kid into a school. Even if you appreciate the idea of wanting to raise a kid in America, that's a wonderful thought. That still does seem very scheme or scheme adjacent to me. Someone might say, well, we got to fix that. But back to our previous conversation before the news, I don't even think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Congress could pass a law prohibiting that if you have the 14th Amendment as the overarching rule that anyone born here is a citizen. You would have to change the Constitution, it would seem, that as the only mechanism to even adjust the circumstances of that. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, if you attack it from the position of the birthright citizenship, you're right. Now, Congress could change the kinds of visas that people are applying for, because these folks from China came lawfully on visas. Mm. So, you know, you could change the statutory scheme and the kinds of visas that someone applies for to come to the country. Now, that does not address the problem of people who are coming across the border, you know, without inspection, illegally, and having children here. But for those that are doing it, you know, maybe they come on a tourist visa or something like that, you could address that through the statute.
Right. We have a text that we often get when you come on, Professor Byes, about people saying, look at what my parents or grandparents did to come to the United States and assimilate and gain their citizenship. They worked hard. They earned it. And there is no doubt that is true for the vast majority of immigrants pre-1950, say. But the laws are different now, and it's always just good to reflect on the idea that perhaps there were more legal channels for people to come to the United States that were open now that simply are not open now. I'm not making excuses for illegal crossings, but I guess I'm asking, Cindy, that if someone just wants to come here, it's not as simple as, sure, I'll just come here.
Yeah, you're right. And we have talked about this before that, you know, 100, 150 years ago, we had very, very few restrictions on immigration. We really had pretty open borders. And well into the 20th century, we didn't have quotas on people coming from the Western Hemisphere. And so there were many more pathways to come to the United States. But nowadays, you must have a visa, either a temporary or a permanent visa. And there's a lot of paperwork and costs and waiting involved in that, oftentimes many years to get a visa. And so it is much more difficult. The numbers of people who want to come are huge, and the numbers of visas available are not that large.
Yeah, I was just reading about Ellis Island. Maybe it was some anniversary of when it closed. I was filling in on another show, and I just was kind of amazed that I think it was 98% of people that landed at Ellis Island who literally got on a boat. They didn't tell anyone ahead of time they were coming to the United States. They didn't file anything with the government. They got on a boat. It came to the United States. It landed at Ellis Island. 98% of them were granted access to the United States. That is just, that would never happen these days.
I think you're absolutely right that, it was a very, very different process back then.
And I'm not making a judgment one way or the other. I'm just pointing that out. Okay. Deportation. We've heard about potential mass deportations. That is something that President-elect Trump has promised. And when you poll Americans, it's popular. People, even amongst Hispanic communities, who would seemingly be people that would be targeted, perhaps, for mass deportation, according to plans. How does a deportation work, Professor Baez? Does someone have to break the law in order to get on the radar of local police to be deported? Or can immigrant forces, ICE forces, go through communities and try and find people who are here illegally and deport them without any, I don't want to say any cause, they were here illegally, of course, but without like some, something that instigated a removal?
Yeah, there's so many different pieces to that that we'll have to sort of break it down into different categories again. So for someone who has crossed the border illegally and who cannot prove that they have been in the United States for a couple of years, particularly if they're near to the border geographically, they might be subject to something called expedited removal. So if they're sort of caught, meaning that, they're stopped by the police and they can't show that they have any permission to be here, they might be removed fairly quickly. Without ever seeing an immigration judge. For folks, though, who have been here a little bit longer or who maybe came on a visa but overstayed or have different kinds of status, if they cannot prove when they are, encounter a law enforcement officer that they are here lawfully, then they would normally go through a process where they would have a chance to talk to an immigration judge if they want to do that. You asked about, can law enforcement go into communities and talk with people? Immigration law is federal law. And so it is the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, that does that in the interior. Customs and Border Patrol at the border, which is also part of the Department of Homeland Security, would do that closer to the border. Normally, you don't have your local police officers getting involved in that process. They're not authorized to deport people. It's the ICE and CBP officers from the federal government that do that. However, there are some local law enforcement agencies that cooperate with the federal government. There's a process by which they can sign what's called a 287 agreement, and under the statutory provision, and they can be trained, and they can, voluntarily cooperate with the federal government if they arrest someone on a different charge and find out that they don't have proof of lawful presence, turn that person over to the federal immigration authorities. So various things happen, but we do have a Fourth Amendment right in this country to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. So the government, the ICE officers or CBP officers aren't supposed to be, breaking down people's doors. They're supposed to still follow the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment and have reasonable cause or, the right level of suspicion to start asking people, and making arrests of people who they believe might be unlawfully present.
That's what I was just going to ask. So the presumption is that anyone that is physically in the country, legally or not, has the full rights of the Fourth Amendment at their disposal against an unreasonable search, meaning that there must be, in theory, some motivation for why that ICE officer started asking you questions to begin with.
And that is true in most of the United States. There is an area close to the border where the courts have said that there can be a little bit more leniency to the government conducting searches and seizures. But through most of the interior of the country, yes, the Fourth Amendment would apply.
Is this that 100-mile border or something that then people have summarized includes Chicago because we have Lake Michigan and some access points here close to Canada? Have you seen these memes going around? People will say the vast majority of people actually live within that border, that area around the border. Do you see what I'm asking?
I understand what you're asking. I have not seen the memes. I don't know that they're... has been a legal ruling about that, where, you know, the border would be in the Chicago area. But the theory is that because there are people who, you know, cross illegally, and it's usually applied at the southern border, but not exclusively, that the police have a little bit more, the ICE officers and CBP officers have a little bit more leniency to conduct searches and ask questions close to the border than they do in the interior.
What's a trial, or maybe it's not even called the trial? You go before a judge, right? ICE has said that you are here illegally. Do they set a trial date immediately and bring you to them, like when you have an arraignment, or is it come in a couple days or weeks or months, and then you'll have your hearing in front of the judge?
It's quite different than criminal proceedings in many ways. For example, you know, if you're a criminal defendant, you have a right to counsel. If you can't afford one, the government will provide you with one. That is not true in immigration proceedings. You're on your own to find and pay for your legal assistance. The judges are not federal judges in the sense of an Article III judge who's confirmed by the U.S. Senate and appointed by the president. They're administrative law judges. So they are selected through a different process. The same rules of evidence that you would have in a civil or criminal court in federal court wouldn't apply in the same way. So there are less protections for the defendants, if you want to call them that, the immigrants who are in deportation proceedings. You know, the rules of evidence are relaxed, hearsay is allowed as long as relevant, things like that. So there are definitely less protections. And as to timing, the government has been backlogged for quite some time. And so if you are placed in deportation proceedings and you do contest those proceedings and, you know, assert your right to go before an immigration judge, you're likely to be waiting months, if not years, before you see a judge. Some folks are detained for that full amount of time. So they sit in an immigration detention center, sometimes for years, waiting for a hearing.
Okay, but many others are just told, here's your hearing date, or we'll contact you when it's approaching?
Yeah, it depends. There is a bond process that's available for those who are not deemed to be flight risks or dangerous. It is possible for them to apply for bonds and to be released under conditions of supervision. So certainly sort of since COVID and the Biden administration, they've been more lenient with that. At different points in our history, you know, different administrations have been stricter in terms of, you know, who gets a bond and who doesn't.
And Professor, what does deportation look like? Like, who's in charge of physically moving people and where do they end up going?
Yeah, that would be the Department of Homeland Security. So let's assume that you go through your hearing with the immigration judge and you're ordered deported. You will be detained waiting for your actual physical deportation. Most of the time we put people on planes and fly them back to their home country. But we also have to do a certain amount of paperwork with their government to confirm that, yes, they are a citizen of that other country and that that government is taking them back. And sometimes there are delays in that process as well, which cause people to also sit in detention longer. You know, the largest number of people who get deported are still from Mexico, and we have so many and we're so close to Mexico that we have regular deportations to Mexico. But if they come from another country, they might sit a little longer before the paperwork is done and the there's a flight available to send them home. But it is the Department of Homeland Security, you know, the ICE and CBP officers who are the ones that would oversee their detention and removal and who would physically, you know, transport them to the airport and put them on the plane. Sometimes they're allowed, once they're on the plane, to just fly by themselves and, you know, to their home country. Sometimes there is an immigration officer that would accompany them on that flight.
Has there ever been I'm sure there have been, where other countries say, no, we are not taking that person here?
Yes. So, for example, for much of our recent history with Cuba, they have not been in agreement with taking people back. That's varied depending on different agreements over time. There are some other countries, like for a long time, Cambodia didn't take people back. So there's been different countries over the years. Also, sometimes there's just simply not a functioning government that you can even deal with. So, you know, we don't have any relationship with the government, the Taliban in Afghanistan right now. Mm-hmm. Over the years, sometimes Sudan has been in the midst of a civil war and there's been no government there that we can send people back to. And sometimes the person says, oh, you know, I worked with a man several years ago who believed that he was Jordanian and born in Jordan, but he had no paperwork to prove it. He didn't have a birth certificate or anything like that, you know, no living relatives. The government of Jordan said, well, you know, before we take him back, we want to verify that this man is actually one of our own. And so that process took quite a long time. So, you know, those situations arrive as well. It's not that the government doesn't want them. They just want to make sure it's one of their own citizens.
I'm not making a value statement whether any of this is good, bad, or indifferent. This all sounds incredibly expensive.
It is incredibly expensive.
Deporting people takes time, money, and resources, and it seems like a lot of it.
It does. You know, honestly, detaining people is very expensive. The average cost of detaining someone in an immigration detention center is more than $100 per day per person. So the longer we have people staying in detention, the more we're spending on that. And then, of course, you have the cost of the immigration hearings. You have the cost of the actual deportation, which is, you know, a plane ticket. So that's probably actually the least of the costs. It's more the legal procedures and the detention that really costs a lot of money.
Are those folks that go in front of the judge allowed to have a lawyer, or they have to procure one themselves? Like, I know it's different than the criminal situation where you're allowed and you're, in fact, guaranteed a right to a defendant or defendant's attorney. How does that work from an immigration perspective?
They do have a right to have an attorney, but at their own expense. So they have to find their own lawyer and pay for their own lawyer.
Okay. This is more of a broader question. Obviously, a new administration does bring about some changes. And I guess, broadly speaking, a new president can make some sweeping judgments in terms of immigration, the people that are currently here and the ones that may still be trying to come to the United States, Professor Bies. But there are limits to what a president can do. I know that really wasn't a question. I guess I was asking you to kind of wax poetic about that thought of a new administration.
Yeah. So we always have changes with every administration with respect to immigration law. It's actually one of the difficult things working in this field because the rules are constantly shifting, even within the same administration. But,
true.
You know, the president has the ability to exercise a fair amount of discretion in terms of, you know, how much resources do they want to put into detaining people, arresting them, deporting them, et cetera. You know, what groups do they want to concentrate on? You know, every president in my adult life has said that we're going to go after the criminals first, which I think most of us would agree is an appropriate priority. And so those who have committed crimes beyond being unlawfully present, you know, but maybe who have engaged in armed robbery or, you know, other kinds of crimes, those are always the priority of the government to arrest and detain and remove those folks if they're not already in, you know, the criminal justice system. But beyond that, then I think sometimes, you know, people might have different priorities. Sometimes the government exercises some prosecutorial discretion if the person is not lawfully present, but has family members here who are lawfully present or who are dependent on that person. If the person has not committed any other crimes, you know, there might be some equities that would suggest that the government not take immediate action against that person and instead concentrate on someone who we think is more of a danger to our country. So there's a lot of prosecutorial discretion. As I mentioned earlier, there are a number of programs, too, like temporary protected status. The president makes the determination initially of whether to create temporary protected status, of course, along with his advisors and, you know, his whole apparatus, not just the president. But, you know, when that's usually granted for about 18 months, and when that expires, the president could decide not to renew it. The figures I've seen is that we probably have a little over 1 million people in the country under some form of temporary protected status right now. And if the Trump administration wanted to let all of those programs expire, it's possible that they could do that.
Mm-hmm. Got one last question from the 773. Is it true that many people coming to the United States, immigrating here, or trying to do so, spend thousands and thousands of dollars to get people here, whether it's legally or illegally? People spend money to try and get in.
Absolutely. You know, it is not an inexpensive process to get a visa. Several years ago, the government decided that immigration should be self-supporting. In other words, they have to charge enough fees to pay for the administrative costs of processing and granting visas. And so the costs of applying for a visa have gone up significantly. The cost of applying for citizenship has gone up significantly. And so there's just the cost of the paperwork. And then if you employ an attorney to assist you with the process, of course, that's probably a few thousand dollars, if not, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, depending on how long the process is and how complicated it is. So, yes, there's quite a bit of money spent in that process. And that doesn't even take into account those who enter illegally using what we sometimes refer to as a coyote, you know, someone who helps you cross the border illegally. And that can cost several thousand dollars as well.
All right. Professor Buys, I took up all your time. I'm so sorry. And we took up the entire 2 o'clock hour there. It was interesting stuff. A lot of great questions coming in. Thanks for giving us a matter of fact look at everything.
You're very welcome. And I know we have a lot of changes ahead, so it's always good to review where we're at and think about what the future might hold. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
As always, that's Professor Cindy Buys.